now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
Hello, everyone. Today, we're in a new Delphi podcast. Today, I'm hosting John Adler. John Adler is a person that shaped how I view blockchains in a fundamental way and helped me figure out all these difficult parts of the blockchain space and so many times when I was having trouble. But besides that, he's the co-founder of Celestia and the creator of the optimistic roll-up paradigm. I'm very excited to be hosting him today. Welcome, John.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's dive in. Celestia is a project that I've been following from a while now. In my own opinion, I see it as the most beautiful thing since Bitcoin and Ethereum. But I would like to start with the easiest question. In your own words, how do you define Celestia?
In one sentence, Celestia is the first modular blockchain network. And to expand on this, we're going to presumably talk a little bit about modular blockchains later on, because I'm guessing it's going to be a pretty big topic of this episode. But essentially, the project that pioneered this notion of a modular blockchain. That is now kind of taking the blockchain world by storm that people are super excited about. You see things like L2, 2022, and so on that are, you know, leveraging the modular blockchain paradigm. You know, the entire Ethereum roadmap has been changed essentially to be not entirely modular, but let's say semi-modular. Other blockchains are also pivoting to have more modularity, things like Tezos and whatnot. So. Celestia was the first blockchain to pioneer this paradigm.
So help us a little bit understand this better. What is modularity? How do you define modularity? Because it's a relatively new concept for many people, although maybe not for you. So what do you mean exactly when you mean modular blockchains?
Okay, so I should probably... Before answering that question directly, I should probably answer another question, taking a step back, which is, what is a monolithic blockchain, which is the counterpart to modular? What is a monolithic blockchain, and how did it come to be that blockchains traditionally have been monolithic? By traditionally, I mean literally every blockchain prior to Celestia has been monolithic. So when Nakamoto wrote the Bitcoin design paper, he described that you can solve the double spending problem if everyone is aware of everyone else's transactions. In that case, you can take the first one as the valid one and ignore subsequent attempts to double spend. Right, this is like in the introduction or whatever, the Bitcoin design paper. He then proceeds to implement Bitcoin and not do this. The way he implements Bitcoin is that Bitcoin is implemented that the first attempt to spend, the first valid attempt to spend a coin is included in the blockchain, and then subsequent attempts are not in the blockchain, rather they're rejected altogether. So the Bitcoin blockchain only contains valid transactions, which is actually not what was written in the design paper. The design paper says, if everyone knows all transactions, then you can just take the first valid one and ignore subsequent ones. And that thing that Nakamoto describes is actually a modular blockchain, where as long as you make all of the transaction data available to everyone in the world, and as long as you provide an ordering on it so that people know which transaction came before which other transaction, that is sufficient to solve the double spending problem, that is sufficient to build a currency, that is sufficient to build a Turing complete virtual machine like the EVM on top of it. You can do anything you want as long as you have availability and ordering. You don't need execution as well. So a monolithic blockchain is like Bitcoin. It does availability, it does ordering, and it actually does execution of the transactions so that it can exclude invalid transactions. Contrasting to this, a modular blockchain only does availability and ordering of data. It does not execute the data, therefore it allows invalid transactions to be put into the blockchain. Now you might say, well, okay, if you have invalid transactions, who executes them? And the answer is, you have a separate layer on top of your modular data layer. You have an execution layer. And the execution layer is what actually executes the transactions. And like regular blockchains nowadays also have execution layers, it's just they don't have a separate execution layer. The execution layer is tied into the base consensus layer with data availability and ordering. A modular blockchain separates out so that the consensus layer, the base consensus layer, does availability and ordering, and then you have a completely separate execution layer, or more than one. You don't have to just have one, you could have multiple. More than one or more execution layers on top that execute and process the transaction data after it's ordered.
Thank you for this great perspective. So to sum up, Celestia orders data and makes it available and leaves all execution to the client side, instead of forcing everyone in the blockchain, in the Celestia chain, to execute every transaction. So this is really already looks like a paradigm shift, but this doesn't explain by itself the data availability problem and data availability sampling, right? So Celestia takes this one step further, and it addresses the problem of data availability, the known as the data availability problem. This is such a subtle nuance in the blockchain space. So could you help us understand what is this problem that Celestia solves? What do you refer to when you say the data availability problem?
Okay, so the data availability problem is one where you need the data, you need all the transaction data to be published, and everyone must know and agree that this data has been published in order to have a secure blockchain. Why is this? Well, if the data wasn't published, then you wouldn't be able to actually execute the transactions. You wouldn't actually be able to validate the transactions if the data isn't published. Right? So you need an agreement among the nodes in the system that data has been published. Now, for traditional blockchains, things like how Bitcoin and Ethereum were first made, this is like two steps away. Like we're like two levels of indirection here from the data availability problem, because these blockchains were designed without light clients in mind. They were designed where users would just run full nodes, and if you don't run a full node, you basically have no security whatsoever. You're just trusting that the miners or the validators and proof of stake or whatever are just doing things honestly, and if they don't do things honestly, you could get tricked and like lose all your money and stuff, right? So they require everyone to run a full node, which is just fundamentally not scalable, because fully validating the EVM is a very expensive task, right? You can't do that on a cheap computer. You need a pretty damn powerful computer to validate the EVM, keep up with it and stuff, large amounts of hard disk space, large amounts of SSD space, and so on. So if we go a step beyond, everyone is required to run a full node, we can say, okay, well, some people can run a light node. And these people who run a light node, we don't want them to just run a light node where you trust that a majority of miners are honest. You want to run a light node where you can have a fraud proof, or you can have a ZK proof, that the blocks are either invalid or invalid, therefore you have a trust minimized light client. Right, so you have a light client with approximately the same security guarantees as a full node, Now, assuming someone can produce a fraud proof or a ZK proof, which is, no, it's close to it, right? Like, we can discuss the debate about the nuance and stuff, but like, for all intents and purposes, it's pretty close to it. Now, there's a problem, which is that a full node, prior to actually executing the transactions, prior to actually validating every single block, it will download that block. So if your threat model is everyone is running a full node, you don't have a data availability problem because the full nodes naturally have to fully download every block. But if you're now in this better model, if you're in this model where we want to go towards, where people are running full nodes, and there's also a large number of people running trust minimized light clients that use fraud or validity proofs, these light clients don't download the full block. Right? So it could be the case that block producers, miners or validators, will create a new block, so they'll publish the header of the block. They'll publish it around, so light clients will see the header. They'll see, okay, 2/3 of validators have signed off on this block. Or they'll see, okay, this header is in the longest chain if you're using proof of work. And the light clients will accept that header. But full nodes cannot now produce proof that the block is invalid. Right? They can't produce a fraud proof because the data is withheld. There's some nuance here around validity proofs, which I won't get into. But let's just take the fraud proof case because it's easier to reason about. You know, for fraud proofs, well, a full node can't produce a fraud proof to prove to a light client that the block is invalid because they just don't have the data. It hasn't been published. And this is where the data availability problem comes in. When you want to build these trust minimized light clients, you need a solution to data availability. And the solution can't just be, well, everyone has to fully download the entire block.
Right. So essentially, full nodes can protect all the light nodes with fraud and validity proofs. But in order to do so, they must have all data available. And if light nodes don't have a way to ensure that, then they cannot rely on the fraud and data availability proofs. Do I understand
exactly
this correctly?
Yes. And then they essentially degenerate to the insecure light clients. They just degenerate to trusting an honest majority of the validator set because the full nodes can't actually do their job of producing fraud proofs. So what is the solution? Well, this obviously segues into, well, how do you solve this, right? The problem about data availability, or rather the opposite of that, which is data withholding, when someone withholds data and hides it, is that it's not a uniquely attributable fault. So we'll consider three parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. Okay, Alice is the block producer, she produces a block, Bob is the full node, and Charlie is the light node, right? Or I can just use block. I can just say block producer, full node, and light node. Actually, that's probably better as opposed to using names. Okay, so there's a block producer, there's a full node, there's a light node, right? So the block producer withholds. So consider scenario one: the block producer produces a block header, and they withhold the block data from the full node. Now the full node then tells the light node, "Hey, block producer is block producer is withholding the data, right? I don't have the data." Block producer is withholding it. So the light node then asks the block producer, hey, you're withholding the data. Can I see it? Can you prove to me that the data is available? Let me start trying to download it, right? Then the block producer will then give the light node the full block. He'll just publish it, right? Now the light node thinks that the full node has tricked it, has maliciously raised an alarm that the block is unavailable, except the block producer is giving the light node the data. The data is available from the perspective of the light node. And this is what we mean by non-uniquely attributable, is that this third-party observer, this light node, does not actually know which one of the two is telling the truth, right? Each of the two parties, of course, know which one is telling the truth. Like, the full node knows that it's being it knows that it hasn't received the data, right? The block producer knows it's being malicious, but the light node can't tell the difference, right? Because in this scenario, the light node has been tricked into thinking that the full node is malicious when it's not. So how do we get around this? Which is that nodes cannot rely on a third party to tell them whether data is available or not. They must determine themselves whether data is available or not. Now, in a regular, like I said, you don't do anything fancy. The regular thing nodes do is light nodes can't determine this, and full nodes determine whether data is available or not by just fully downloading the whole block. Obviously, this doesn't work because a light node can't fully download a whole block, otherwise it's not a light node, it's a full node. Right? So we need a solution for light nodes to be able to determine, is this data available or not, without downloading the full block. That's the problem statement. How do we do it? We do We use data availability sampling. And Mustafa kind of formalized this technique in a paper, Mustafa being one of my co-founders at Celestial Labs. He published a paper formalizing this technique, co-authored with Vitalik Buterin, among other people. And essentially it works as follows, which is that you use this thing called erasure coding. And erasure coding is used for error correction and so on, things like CD-ROMs and whatnot. And it allows you to add extra redundancy to some piece of data. So you make the, if you have, you know, 100 bytes, you make it 200 bytes, for instance. You make it larger. You add redundancy. But the nice thing is that you no longer need every single bit in the original piece of data to be correct. You can actually interpolate broken or incorrect parts of the data. You can repair data. Right? So the redundancy allows you to repair incorrect data. And this is especially useful in things like CD-ROMs, because if you're familiar with physical media, they can get messed up very easily. Right? They can get scratched. They, you know, it's magnetic, you pass a magnet over it, maybe it gets messed up a bit. If it's not very, it's not very high quality, maybe a magnet messes it up or something, right? There's a million things that can happen to physical media, and if one little scratch just ruined the whole CD, that'd be terrible, right? So instead, what you do is you use this error correction, you use erasure codes, so that even if a lot of the data is corrupted, you can still recover the original data. And this is kind of fundamentally the thing that data availability sampling uses, is that you take a block, you make the block larger, and then rather than having to download the full block, you kind of randomly sample parts of this erasure-coded block. Now, you kind of went from a problem of 100% availability to a problem of 50% availability. What does that mean? If you have just the original block, no erasure coding, just the original block, the block producer can hide all but one piece of the block, and then no one in the entire network can reconstruct the whole block because they can't actually reconstruct that one piece. Right? If there's 100 pieces, they hide one piece. Even if they publish the other 99 pieces, the network can't reconstruct that one last piece. Right? But with erasure coding, let's say you extend it to 200 pieces, if they try to hide more than half of the pieces, then the way the erasure coding, you choose the parameter that as long as you have any 100 of those 200 pieces, you can reconstruct all 200. You can reconstruct both the original 100 and then use that to reconstruct all 200. So you only need any 100, not the first 100, just any 100 out of those 200. So any half.
So first we started with 100. We expanded it to 200, and now we can basically collect any 100 of that 200 extended data to reconstruct the original data. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So because of this, it means if the block producer tries to hide, let's say 99 pieces, that means he's publishing 101 pieces, which means all of the pieces can be reconstructed, right? If the block producer hides 101 pieces, then no one can reconstruct everything, but now he has to hide 101 pieces as opposed to just one. And you see, well, 101 out of 200 is approximately half, while 1 out of 100 is close to zero. Right, so you've turned a 100% problem into a 50% problem, and what this means is that every time you do a random sample, every time you ask the block producer, give me one of these pieces, you have a 50% chance of being tricked, that he's giving you a piece, but he isn't actually publishing enough pieces to the network for the network to be able to reconstruct the block. So 50% chance of being tricked, okay, so if you keep repeating this process, every time you do a random sample, you have 50% chance of being tricked, but being tricked twice in a row is only 25% chance. Being tricked three times in a row is, you know, 1 over 2 to the power of 3, so it's 12.5%, and so on. So it actually, the chance of you being tricked as you do more samples decreases exponentially, and interestingly enough, it decreases exponentially regardless of the block size. Right, I said the first time you have a 50% chance of being tricked. At no point did I say anything about how large the block is. And this is where like the really powerful thing comes in, because data availability sampling, the sampling process requires a constant number of samples to get some sort of confidence interval that you aren't being tricked. So let's say you set the sampling parameter to 10. That means it's, you know, 1 over 2 to the power of 10. So it's approximately, you know, 1,000th chance that you can be tricked, right? You can even set the number of samples to 20, and that's 1 in 1,000,000 that you're being tricked, right? That's a pretty strong guarantees if you set the constant to 20. But that's constant. It has nothing to do with the size of the block, which means that the number of sampling requests you have to do, regardless of the block is 1 megabyte or 1 gigabyte or 1 terabyte, is constant, which is very powerful. Now you might say, well, John, this seems like amazing. It means you can scale block sizes infinitely. Not exactly, because it turns out that in order to make this secure, you need to arrange the data instead of just extending it like a single line. You arrange it in a square, and then you extend the square in two dimensions. And you need commitments to each row and to each column, which means the actual cost is, if you're familiar with asymptotic runtime or storage notation, it's big O of n, or it's big O of square root of n. So in other words, it's proportional to the square root of the block size. Now this is not constant, but it's much better than having to download the full block, right? Like instead of having to, like if you have a 1 megabyte block, instead of having to download 1 megabyte, you're downloading 1 kilobyte, right? If you have a 1 terabyte block, then you're downloading 1 megabyte. So the scaling factor here is amazing, because that means light nodes have to download a very small portion of the block, these commitments, the square root proportionally to the square root of the block size, and then they do a constant number of samples, and that's all the work they have to do. Then they can determine for themselves whether block data is available or not, and then going back up to our trust minimized light clients. Now, when you combine that with fraud or validity proofs, now you have the complete solution. Now you have trust minimized light clients.
Perfect. That was a very in-depth explanation. Thank you for that. If I were to sum up it all in my own words, do you mind if I can do that for a bit? Just so this is communicated. So basically, light nodes, they each download something that is proportional to the square root of the block size. And they basically, by doing so, they ensure that the whole block has been made available to all the full nodes, so that the full nodes can protect them with validity and fraud proofs. And in this paradigm, is basically a light node kind of loses meaning, because it's almost like a full node. It's a light node, but it's a fully verifying node. It verifies the integrity of all the transactions. This is extremely extremely powerful. So I'd like to shift gears a bit now to back to the decoupling of execution and data. When the execution is separated from when there's the execution off chain, then but data on chain, that is referred to as rollups. And you're the creator of the optimistic rollup paradigm. So is there any differences between Ethereum rollups and rollups on Celestia? I know rollups on Celestia are often referred to as sovereign chains, like blockchains, rather than some like a baby chain to the base layer, like Ethereum rollups operate. Can you elaborate on that point a little bit?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the many advantages of a fully modular blockchain stack, which is what Celestia provides, as opposed to like a semi-modular blockchain stack, which is what you would get out of Ethereum and its rollups, which is that, let's consider a rollup on Ethereum, right? A rollup on Ethereum has a rollup contract on Ethereum as its settlement layer, and it uses Ethereum's EVM as a settlement layer. And the rules, the consensus rules of the rollup, in other words, what state transitions, what transactions are valid, right? Those rules must be encoded in the smart contract. Right? It must be encoded in the smart contract. And what this means is, if you want to change the rules of the rollup, which very often you want to, right? Look how many hard forks Ethereum went through, right? It went through, I don't know, half a dozen hard forks, right? And also soft forks, right? Look how many soft forks Bitcoin went through, right? So any fork, soft or hard, is still a change to the consensus rules. If you want to change those rules for a rollup where the rules must be encoded in a smart contract on Ethereum, well, you can't, because the smart contract is immutable. It cannot be changed. And the only way you can do this properly is you either have a multisig, right? The developers have a multisig that allow them to upgrade the contract, or you have a DAO, where it's plutocracy, right? Where the coin holders are the ones who control the rollup, essentially. They would completely control the consensus rules of the rollup. They can do whatever they want. They can steal all the money. Neither of these options are how blockchains work, like layer one blockchains work today, right? Like Ethereum, for instance, is not controlled by a multisig, right? Vitalik and Daddy Vitalik and Vlad and Gavin don't all get together in a multisig to determine the hard forks on Ethereum, right? Likewise, Ethereum is not owned and controlled solely by CoinVote, right? And in fact, the Ethereum community has been vocally against on-chain governance in other chains like Polkadot, right? And vocally against it, they've been all about users control the chain. Right? Users control the chain, so there's no on-chain governance. It's off-chain governance, right? It's messy, it's ugly, but it allows users to ultimately have sovereignty over the Ethereum chain. But you can't do that with a smart contract. You can't do that because you only have two options, either multisig or DAO, essentially, which is the DAO's coin holder vote. So what do rollups on Celestia give you? Since Celestia itself does not have its own settlement layer enforced, right? It means that if you build a rollup on Celestia that just uses Celestia for data availability, that rollup can change its consensus rules. It can hard fork, it can soft fork, and it can do whatever it wants. And Celestia itself cannot stop this in any way, and it cannot restrict this in any way, because the rollup is simply using for Celestia for data availability and nothing else. It's not using Celestia for validity. And this is where the notion of sovereign rollups comes in, because these rollups that run natively on Celestia are sovereign. They can hard fork. They can change their consensus rules. Users can own them as opposed to coin holders. Users control them. It's sovereign to the users. And Celestia can't stop you. It's simply a credibly neutral data availability layer that anyone can use to deploy anything they want. And I kind of want to maybe interject here, because you can say, couldn't you use Bitcoin like this? Or couldn't you use Ethereum for this too? Like, do you have to use Ethereum as a settlement layer for your rollup? Or could you have a rollup that runs entirely just in call data on Ethereum and just uses Ethereum for data availability and ordering? The answer is yes, you could, but it would be very expensive to do so. Since Celestia is specifically optimized just for data availability, it means it can provide a much higher throughput off data availability at the base layer, because the base layer doesn't also have to do a bunch of other stuff. It's just data availability. And Celestia gives you the flexible option that if you want to have a rollup like you have on Ethereum, right? If you don't want to have a sovereign rollup for whatever reason, you can actually build a settlement layer as a sovereign rollup, then build non-sovereign rollups on top of that. And there's nothing stopping you from doing that. So Celestia gives you optionality.
Thank you for that. Rollups could have been used Ethereum and Bitcoin for as data layer only and do execute all execution on their own. But you said it's expensive, whereas Celestia is data layer is scalable. How much exactly scale are we talking about here? And I'd like to expand on this question. Like, when we see Celestia finally come to life in the mainnet on day one, how much scale data availability throughput do you expect it to have? And over time, what can become a bottleneck here on the scale? Yeah.
It's hard to know. We do have a DevNet running. It seems to be running pretty smoothly. The decision on what the actual parameters will be depends on what the community wants ultimately, but I expect it to be several orders of magnitude, even just off the start, compared to what Ethereum can do today. So add a few zeros.
Alrighty. That was pretty clear. Okay. So let's shift our focus a bit to how you're going to bootstrap an ecosystem. How do you expect to plan to bootstrap the ecosystem, Celestia ecosystem? Obviously, if you only do the data ordering and availability, you can't build an ecosystem just with just that. You have to have execution. So one strategy here is basically rollups natively launching on Celestia. But I also know that you have a second solution where an existing Ethereum rollup can also make use of Celestia. How is this plan to be implemented, and what are the trade-offs of such a solution? Would like to hear your thoughts on it.
Sure. So we have kind of two prongs. One of them is Sevmos, which maybe we can talk about a bit later. The other one is Celestiums, which we can talk about right now because they directly answer your question. So a Celestium, which is, I guess, a portmanteau of Celestia and then borrowing the ums from things like Validiums. So Celestiums are essentially the notion that you can have a rollup. It runs on top of Ethereum, so it uses Ethereum for settlement. And then it uses an external source for guaranteeing data availability. Now, Validiums, are you familiar with Validiums? Or should I refresh the audience?
I think it would be good to have an intro about Validiums for those who may not be that familiar, yes.
Okay, so Validium is kind of like a ZK rollup in that it uses a validity proof to ensure transaction validity. And it does not post data on chain. Since it doesn't post data on chain, it could be vulnerable to a data withholding attack, right? So all your funds could be frozen. So how do they resolve that? Is that most Validiums use what's known as a data availability committee, where it's some group of famous people or whatever that essentially sign off that, yes, the data behind this block is available. That's all they do. They don't post it on chain, on Ethereum chain. They just sign off and say, the data is available. Can we do better than that, right? And this is where Celestiums come in. With a Celestium, you have the same thing, where you have something that looks like a rollup, right? It's a blockchain. It settles to Ethereum. It posts either validity or fraud proofs to Ethereum, and it keeps data off-chain. But it doesn't keep data just you know, in a few databases on some famous people's computers. No, no, no. A Celestium will post its data to Celestia. And then we are building this thing called the quantum gravity bridge that allows any smart contract on Ethereum to consume an attestation from the Celestia validator set that some data is on the Celestia chain and that is available. So essentially it's a relay or it's a bridge, whatever you want to call it, from Celestia to Ethereum that now downstream contracts can use it. And for all intents and purposes, they can say, here are Celestia blocks. They we have a validator set signatures that these blocks are in fact on the real Celestia chain. Now, why would you do this? Why wouldn't you just use a data availability committee? Why is a Celestium strictly better than that? Why does it provide better security guarantees? So a data availability committee, if it lies, right, if it lies, and they sign off on data, and so they say this data is available, but it's not. Users' funds can get stolen if it's an optimistic Validium, whatever you want to call that. If it's a Validium with validity proofs, then funds can't get stolen, but they can get frozen. And since they're frozen, you can get blackmailed. So freezing funds is the same as stealing them. They're the same thing, really.
And when you mean frozen, I think you're referring to the case where the data is not available, so no one can no one besides the attackers who withhold the data can now generate validity proofs. So
that's correct. Right. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, then effectively your funds are frozen, right? They're burned because you can't move them. You can't move them. You can't withdraw them. Right? You can't produce a new block, so they're effectively gone. And then from there, the whoever's holding your funds can hold them hostage and just blackmail you. And so on.
This is also why having data is a prerequisite for validity proofs as well, and not just fraud proofs. Because I think this is one of the common misconceptions in the space. So I wanted to clarify it.
Yep, it is a common misconception. Yeah, and this is why ZK rollups exist as opposed to just Validium. ZK rollups exist because data withholding is a problem, even if you use ZK proofs. Okay, so getting back to the example, right, a data availability committee lies, they withhold the data, but they claim on Ethereum that it is available. You have no recourse. You have no way of penalizing these people, except potentially for their reputation. Like, okay, I guess their reputation gets hurt, but like, that's not a penalty, right? it's not a crypto economic penalty. There's no penalty if these people lie, and therein lies the issue. with if you use another blockchain, especially if the other blockchain is a proof of stake blockchain as opposed to a proof of work blockchain, if those validators lie, then you can slash them, right? You can't. Sure, they can corrupt the bridge, and they can corrupt it for all time, sure, but they can and will be penalized through a hard fork on the other chain that you're using for data availability. They can be penalized, they can be slashed, they can potentially lose billions of dollars. That is a concrete crypto economic penalty, right, that you can leverage. And this is where using Celestia or potentially another blockchain, but Celestia happens to be, it's going to be, you know, the blockchain that's most highly optimized for data throughput out of all of them. So you might as well use the best one for the job. The other blockchain that you're using for data, the fact that it's a blockchain and the fact that it's running proof of stake and that you can slash them versus a data availability committee where the only thing that's at stake is their reputation, that makes it strictly better because you have this strong crypto economic security. In addition to this, using Celestia specifically as opposed to just any chain, for instance, instead of a data availability committee, someone could say, okay, well, let's spin up our own proof of stake chain. And all this proof of stake chain does is just attest the data availability for this one application, right? Though that's better than a data availability committee because at least you have some penalty, but there's the issue that it's only for one application. If many applications use Celestia, not just Celestiums, but also native rollups on Celestia, and also other stuff that runs on Celestia and other blockchains and so on, Cosmos zones, whatever, what have you, all of these will essentially add security together. Their security is additive, right? Because every single one of them is paying towards the same security budget, which means the security provided by the shared data availability layer by Celestia will grow as more applications use it. So combining these two factors, Celestiums will provide very strong crypto economic guarantees, right, in the form of, well, if the Celestia validators lie, they're going to get slashed, and also the security budget of Celestia will be higher than what you get out of a single committee or a single, you know, application-specific committee, and it'll be higher than probably most, if not any, other chain because it's specifically optimized for this purpose. You know, not just for running one application on it, but for running many different rollups, many different applications, right? So let's just specifically optimize for this. So you get very high security guarantees, and you're going to get, at least at the beginning, very low cost, but at least the guarantee is you'll have very high throughput capacity for data availability, much higher than what you get out of Ethereum, much higher than you get out of any monolithic chain, which is perfect for rollups, right? Because rollups are very data hungry.
And also, like, a point that I wouldn't want to miss there is basically all of these applications using the same layer would also imply that they share the same data availability guarantees. So basically, we'll be tapping into the same security layer.
And I should also point one other thing, which is that data availability sampling is done on a per block basis, right? So if you had, for instance, multiple applications, or if you had multiple subchains, let's say in the ETH2 sharding model, you have multiple subchains. You have 64 subchains, right? 64 shards. You have to do data availability sampling for each of these. And this means you're doing extra work. The best way to get the most scale out of data availability sampling is by having very large blocks. Because, as we said, the scaling factor is square root of the block size, right? And if we take this to an extreme to show why large blocks are good, you know, the square root of 1 is 1. So if you had like a block with one piece, data availability sampling wouldn't help you. You'd still have to download the full block. But if you had a block size of 1 million, for instance, the square root of 1 million is 1,000. Hopefully I didn't get that wrong because doing head math is bad. All right, the square root of 1 million is 1,000. Now you can see, wow, you're getting 1,000 scaling factor. Or if you increase this more, the square root of some larger number than 1 million is still, it's going to be proportionally smaller because you have the scaling factor of the square root of the block size. So you want large blocks, and what that means is you want to have a small number of these data layers. You don't want to have, you know, a large number of small data layers. You want to have a smaller number of larger data layers. So if all of these, let's say, you know, you have 10 Celestiums all using Celestia, users can actually go in, run a Celestia light node, and they would only have to run one Celestia light node, as opposed to having to run 10 and still have to do about the same work for each of them. So in total, they're doing maybe like 8 times more work. Right? They just run one Celestial Light node, and they can be guaranteed that data is available.
So the scalability benefits is basically come from how like the bigger the block gets, the scalability advantages start to like emerge more beneficial. We start to see more beneficial advantages. So I'd like to ask you a devil's advocate question. So there is a so basically with data availability sampling, what we end up getting after all said and done is basically some light nodes that have the same, nearly same security guarantees of full nodes. But there is some a camp in crypto that basically regards data availability sampling as something nice to have, security property, but not a must have. And the one reason they think this way is basically, so they say the majority of economic activity in the chain already goes through full nodes. So these are centralized exchanges, fiat on-off ramp. These kind of participants, they run full nodes and they have a full, they essentially protect the economic activity in the chain. And that, so why should we optimize for average light nodes if that's the case? Or would that bring any additional meaningful security kind of thing? So do you see, what are your thoughts on this? And like, to expand on that, is there a throughput level beyond which data availability sampling becomes important, from something nice to have to a must have?
Yeah, so I would say we want to generally move away from a world in which the majority of economic activity goes through centralized exchanges. Right? Like, that is true that that might be the current state of affairs, but I think we would all agree in the blockchain space that we don't want that to be the end goal, right? We would like to be in a world where users have as much sovereignty as possible. And that means users will have to run their own nodes. And it's simply not possible for all users to run full nodes. Like, that just won't happen. Even Bitcoin. Bitcoin, to run a full node is very cheap in Bitcoin, right? You can just have an old hard disk, you can have a Raspberry Pi, and you can run a Bitcoin full node. Even then, not too many people do it compared to how many people use Bitcoin. Right, so we want to work towards a world where people are sovereign. There's a notion of sovereignty. Users control the chain. Users run their own nodes, but users aren't going to run full nodes even today. So we need a secure alternative. We need trust minimized light nodes, and those don't really exist yet for layer one chains. They exist in the form of rollups on Ethereum, for instance, where the rollup itself is trust minimized and it runs a trust minimized light client on the Ethereum chain, but Ethereum itself is not trust minimized. You can't have a trust minimized light client of Ethereum itself, right? So there's not, you're kind of only doing half of the work if you have a rollup, because users still need to run an Ethereum full node to get the security guarantees of a rollup. If not, they're just trusting the majority of Ethereum miners, and if they're doing that, their rollup isn't really a rollup. It's some Frankenstein thing. Right, so we want a world where the entire stack is trust minimized, and that you can run just a trust minimized light client, and this gives you guarantees across the entire stack. That at no point do you have to run a full node to get strong security guarantees. And that world, and the kind of the, you said, well, what's the threshold of requirements and stuff, and I'm going to respond by saying it's already the case, even with Bitcoin. It's already the case that people don't run full nodes, even with something as cheap as Bitcoin. So trust minimized light clients, the notion of light clients with data availability sampling with fraud or validity proofs is already needed today.
Obviously this is a world that I'd like to live in. So can't argue against it. So let's try to have some of your vision for the future of blockchains. One future of doing things the way Celestia imagines is basically over a pure data availability layer, you can run any execution environment. You don't have to be forced to run EVM or another execution layer. You can pretty much be VM agnostic. So in this context, how do you view the future of execution environments, VMs, in blockchain in, let's say, 3 years from now or 5 years from now? Can you share some of your perspective?
Sure. So it might be on the topic of multiple VMs, it might be worth reiterating kind of what Celestia allows you to do versus some other blockchains, right? So if you have a blockchain like Ethereum, for instance, Ethereum has one virtual machine. It has the EVM. That's all you can do. You can't at the enshrined consensus level have another virtual machine, right? You can build sidechains, for instance, and you can build rollups, but the consensus protocol itself won't allow you to have any other virtual machine other than if you do that, right? And since any rollup must have a settlement contract that runs in the EVM, you're kind of pretty restricted in what you can do, even if you decide to use a different virtual machine for your rollup. Okay, so there's other chains, for instance, Avalanche, right? Avalanche has this notion of subnets, but subnets are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, which is that if you have a new subnet that you just spin up out of nowhere, it's not a subnet at that point, it's another blockchain. Right? Even if it uses the Avalanche consensus protocol, it's just another blockchain. It's not a subnet. It has nothing to do with the main Avalanche network. Right? If you just spin it up, it doesn't share security. So you can spin up a new thing. You can launch. You can have it have a new virtual machine, but it has nothing to do with the main Avalanche network. And this is the same thing that Cosmos have. A lot of there's not really too much innovation that happens on the Avalanche side, other than their consensus protocol. Right, the notion of you can have what they call subnets is exactly the same as Cosmos zones. Right, just Cosmos is substantially farther ahead in terms of developing their Cosmos SDK and so on. Right, so Cosmos zones, similarly, you can develop it using Cosmos SDK and launch it. It has nothing to do with the Cosmos Hub. It has nothing to do with Atom. It's a completely separate chain. Right. On the other hand, Avalanche is also saying, okay, well, you can launch a subnet that the Avalanche validators must validate. Right. Well, the problem is that if you have a subnet that the validators must validate and that all full nodes of the system must also validate, that's not a subnet. That's just like, it's not even a shard either. It's not even a shard. It's just an extension block kind of, right? You're just doing more work. You're just increasing the block size. And sure, you're saying part of the state uses this VM, part of the state uses that VM, but still it's just larger blocks, right? It's not scaling. It's larger blocks, right? Celestia does something different fundamentally, which is that since Celestia itself does not enshrine any execution layer, does not require anything, and since execution layers on Celestia are sovereign, all of the execution layers on Celestia will share security, so they're not separate blockchain, they share security, because, you know, if they post their data to Celestia, you cannot then remove that data or change it around unless you change the Celestia chain. Right? So it's sharing security, it allows communication between the rollups, not through Celestia, but even between themselves in a trust-minimized manner, because they are guaranteed that other rollups will know the blocks off other rollups because they're all available. They're all there on Celestia. And these execution layers can run whatever VM they want. And Celestia does not care because Celestia validators do not run the VM. So you get the best of both worlds. You get shared security, like what you get out of Ethereum, but you get the flexibility of sovereignty of running your own chain. And this, the combination of these two properties is unmatched among any of the other examples like I described. And in my opinion, since there is the opportunity to explore new virtual machines, to experiment with new virtual machines, I think the people will explore and experiment. Right? The EVM is kind of not very good, just like how Bitcoin script is not very good. We've learned a lot about what the EVM does wrong, how it could be improved and stuff. But Ethereum itself, its instance of the EVM is shackled by the requirement to maintain backwards compatibility as much as possible with existing contracts. Right? They can't do some of the changes they want to do because it will break existing contracts. And some of the changes they want to do have to be done in hacky ways because otherwise it would break existing contracts. Right, that's something like the self-destruct instruction. The self-destruct instruction, for those of you who aren't familiar, is an instruction in the Ethereum virtual machine that lets you delete a contract. That is like one of the most hated and most despised instructions from client developers. Not just one of, it is the most. It is the worst. The reason it's so bad is because, first of all, it destroys a contract. So now it's like the contract code is not immutable anymore. So that's already messy. But secondly, a self-destruct will also clear all of the contract storage. And the contract could have a lot of storage, right? Like imagine a token contract with 1 million account balances. You now have one instruction that touches 1 million storage slots. It's like just really, really, it's really messy. So this is like the most hated instruction for client developers, but they still haven't removed it after all these years, even though if you were launching a new instance of the Ethereum virtual machine, let's say, you could just turn off that instruction and be done. And you don't have to worry because this new instance of the EVM doesn't have to worry about backwards compatibility. And I'm not sure why no EVM forks have turned this off, but that just goes to show that, you know, maybe there isn't so much innovation happening with all these Geth forks. Anyways, enough dunking on other chains. Going back to the topic at hand, which is that since Ethereum itself, its instance of the EVM is tied down due to this baggage, due to needing to maintain backwards compatibility and not break contracts, the evolution of the EVM has naturally been pretty slow. And there are other virtual machines out there that could be better than it. One example that I'm not going to say is better, but that has fixed some of the problems of the EVM is Solana's C-level. Right, so Solana's C-level runtime and their virtual machine and transaction format allows for parallel transaction execution. Even if you don't care about anything else that Solana's doing and you just look at just that, and let's say the VM doesn't even perform better, other than that, that's already good. Right, it's already doing parallel transaction execution, which has like no one has managed to do properly in the EVM. People have tried and tried and tried. Every single experiment to parallelize the EVM has ended in a failure because it would require such fundamental changes that it would just break everything. Right? So Solana said, okay, we're going to start from scratch. We're going to make a new VM. It's going to have parallel transaction execution. Boom, they did it. Right? They did it. And the Ethereum all-core devs are still arguing over one little instruction or two for the past 2 years. Right? So this is an example where if you aren't limited by backwards compatibility, you can experiment and you should. And this is what I expect to see on Celestia without the, you know, since now people are going to be free to experiment, I expect lots of people to experiment with completely new virtual machine architectures that surpass what the EVM has. And some of them are going to surpass the EVM. Some of them are going to be worse. Some of them are going to be the same, but different in for various applications. Some of them are going to be application specific. That's fine. But I expect a huge wealth of virtual machines, of consensus rules, and so on, to experiment on top of Celestia.
So this is, if you were to like guess a number for like from 3 years from now, like 5 years from now, could you give an estimation on how many chains there could be on Celestia?
At least 69 of them. Maybe we could see somewhere in the range of 400 to 420 of them. Who knows?
All right. Record it for our notes. So one of the questions that the community wanted me to ask is basically this question of how... So in Celestia, because there is no execution, any transaction can be posted on Celestia. Which also involves potentially invalid transactions. So how would, in that case, a roll-up be protected against a spamming case, a DDoS attack, where a roll-up gets spammed with invalid transactions? Could you share your thoughts on that?
Sure. That's actually a very good question that I think a lot of people in the Ethereum community are still struggling with. And it's kind of approached from two fronts. The first is that the original Lazy Ledger paper that Mustafa wrote described posting transaction data. But the way you would implement it in practice is that rather than posting individual transactions for the rollup, what you do is you post rollup blocks in their entirety. In other words, you post a batch of transactions. That automatically solves the problem of individual transaction spam, because now you have blocks. But now we get to the second facet, which is, well, what if the block is invalid, right? What if someone spams you with invalid blocks? And this is kind of where, and this part here is kind of like the knowing that there's transaction batches, that's the easier part. Now comes the time when people have a little, they trip over this, which is that how do you know if a block is invalid or not? Well, an Ethereum client today, like an Ethereum full node, right, or even an Ethereum light node, the first thing it does when it receives a new block is it validates that the block matches some sufficient proof of work, right? If you're in ETH2 land or if you're in Tendermint land, the first thing it does is it says, okay, let me validate, is this block signed by the appropriate, the block header? Is this block header signed by the appropriate people? And if yes, it is, then I start downloading the block. And if, even after all that, if someone has given me an invalid block header or if someone has given me an invalid block, I ban them. I just blacklist them or blocklist, whatever you want to call it, right? You just ban them from your peer-to-peer connection. But there's nothing stopping them from connecting to you in the first place and sending you invalid data. You still have to at least download something, process it, find out they're malicious, and then ban them at the peer-to-peer level. So what I'm saying is Celestia is a replacement to this peer-to-peer distribution network. It is not anything magical. It's a replacement to that. So in that regard, if you see an invalid block header in Celestia, you, as a roll-up full node, what you should do is download the block header, make sure it's signed off on by the correct number of people, in the validator set or the block producer set of your rollup. And then if it is, then download the block. And if the block is fully invalid, then you discard it and move on to the next block. You can't blacklist someone because you can't blacklist, there's no peer-to-peer network that you're receiving blocks from, but you can just ignore the block, right? So in that regard, you're not doing any more work and you're not open to any further denial of service attacks than you are as a peer-to-peer node on Ethereum today or in Bitcoin today. It's exactly the same. Just Celestia, you can think of it like a replacement for the peer-to-peer network. Now you might say, now the third prong of this, because it's like a trident, I guess. It's three. The third prong now is, well, okay, you said there's a block producer set, but, should we just trust the block producer set, right? Like, should we just trust the block producer set? And if we just trust the block producer set to tell us whether it's a block header or not, what's the point of Celestia, right? If we're just trusting the block producer set of this rollup. And this is the biggest stumbling point for people in the Ethereum community, that they don't understand this last point at all. The other ones, they can at least try to. This is the point that they don't understand at all, which is as follows, which is that they are stuck in the world where you only have regular light clients that trust an honest majority, where they say, okay, if you have a block header and it's signed off on by some validator set, that block header is valid to the light client. But that's not how rollups work. Right? Rollups are not light clients, they are trust minimized light clients, right? You run a light client with fraud and data availability proofs. So when you combine, the fact that a rollup client can look at the block headers, can look at the blocks and so on, you can have light clients for rollups, for native rollups on Celestia, but you can't have plain light clients of a native rollup on Celestia, but you can have trust minimized light clients of a rollup on Celestia, where the light client will follow the rollup block headers. Right, it's not fully downloading the rollup blocks, but at least it's ensuring it's available due to the fact that they're being posted to Celestia. It's following the rollup block headers, but it doesn't trust the block producers of the rollups for the validity of the blocks, because it uses fraud or validity proofs. And that is kind of the sticking point that the Ethereum community gets confused, because they say, "Oh, okay, if you're just gonna trust the, you can't have a light client because you, like, if you just follow the chain of block headers that are signed off on, the Celestia serves no purpose." Which is correct, you can't have a light client, but you can have a trust minimized light client. And that is something that doesn't even exist in blockchains today. Like, there's no blockchain today that has a trust minimized light client. The only one that could come close is Mina. They're still under active development. They don't have a solution for the data availability problem, right? So Celestia is building an entire stack where you can have a single trust minimized light client, and this is all you need. You can verify Celestia blocks. That trust minimized light client can have some plugins to also run a trust minimized rollup light client. And essentially, the entire thing is you running one or more light clients, and it's all trust minimized through fraud and data availability proofs. And this is like a complete paradigm shift compared to how blockchains are done today, where people have to run full nodes, or they have to run a light client where they trust the validator set. Did that answer your question? I feel like I...
Yeah, that answers. It's very in-depth and very insightful. That answers, definitely. While we're here, are there some other cases where... are there some other disadvantages, I would say, of doing modular blockchains? Like, from an application perspective, what could be some reason that an application wouldn't want to separate execution from consensus and operate like a normal monolithic blockchain? Do you see some cases like that?
The only issue, really, is that it's going to require a bit more work from developers to get started, to get bootstrapped, because the tooling hasn't been built yet. But this is something that can be solved purely by a bit of engineering effort. Well, okay, I say a bit. It requires engineering effort. So it just requires elbow grease. It is not a fundamental research problem that you might wait 5-10 years and find out, well, I guess there was actually no solution. This is just pure engineering problem, just tooling has to be built. But that's the only issue. There's no downside from a security perspective. There's no downside from a throughput perspective or performance perspective. Everything is at least as good. And for lots of things, it's strictly better by several orders of magnitude. The only thing that's going to be challenging is this initial bootstrapping phase where tooling hasn't been built, where if you're early, you're going to have to probably participate in the building of some of this tooling. That being said, like I always say, if you're early, that's an opportunity.
Absolutely. And just to clarify this, this is the bootstrapping of like the necessary tooling and everything. But in the equilibrium state, I imagine it would be much, much easier to deploy a chain on Celestia, right? Because you don't have to deal with consensus. Can you share your thoughts?
Yeah. So currently, if you're launching, you know, brand new chain, what's like a brand new chain? Well, okay, you have two options. One of them is you run a smart contract and you borrow security from a base chain, but then you're limited. You're not sovereign, right? It's limited to the rules of that chain. You're beholden to those rules. The other thing is you launch your own chain, but then you have to bootstrap your own validator set, right? You have to figure out people to own the token. You don't have to distribute it far and wide. Because even if the block producers are malicious, you can hard fork them out, right? But the problem is that every time you do this, it's cumbersome. So you want to minimize the number of times you do this. You want to maximize the cost of attack. To do this, you want to probably have some semblance of distributing the block producer set, at least a little bit, just to make things more like convenient, right? Essentially, not but that's a fundamental security issue, like lots of maximalists might say, but just for convenience. The end game is that if the block producers are malicious, you can just hard fork them out. So, you know, but still, like, even conducting things, like, the legal requirements of distributing a token, which are quite onerous, right? Then you have to find people to run validator nodes, which could be quite expensive, right? It requires validator infrastructure and so on. Then you have to get your token listed and so on, right? You have to do all these things, and you have to make it extremely liquid, because if you don't have these, then it's going to be very cumbersome. You can kind of remove all of these requirements if you just launch a native rollup directly on top of Celestia and borrow Celestia and like borrow security from Celestia, right? Because you don't have to worry about validators including an invalid block in the chain or doing a withholding attack or anything like that, right? You can just bootstrap your own network even with a single node, and that network will share security with all other chains on Celestia. And that's kind of where the real benefit is. Like, if you just launch your one chain and it's just John Chain, right? Well, John Chain on his own island isn't going to communicate with, you know, Can Chain, right? But the thing is, if we were all on Celestia, then you could communicate between these chains, even with a very small validator set that's untrusted, that doesn't have Y token distribution and stuff, they could all communicate with each other. And that's kind of where the kind of real benefit comes from, that you can have cross-chain communication in a trust minimized manner.
So the last question that I want to ask is, I saved them. Well, we've talked this was a very technical conversation, more technical than I expected, but I saved the most technical one in the very end. So in Celestia paradigm, we have this fully verifying light nodes. So, and that's really good. So basically the what Celestia says that it's okay to request a higher resource requirements from full nodes as long as the these light nodes requirements can be kept low. However, keeping full nodes requirements at a somewhat reasonable level also has a benefit, right? Because it lightens the load on the full nodes on the validators to serve light clients' requests. And also another benefit of being able to run a full node is that you get a better privacy because you don't have to ask for data every time you need it. So you get a better privacy. So is there a plan to like to address this, like keep full nodes requirements at a certain level? If not, how these issues can be addressed?
Okay, so there's a happy middle ground here in the sense that there's a happy middle ground, and I'll kind of take a step back and talk about how fraud proofs would work on an Ethereum chain, right? So if you want to run a node that can produce a fraud proof for an EVM chain, what you need to do is you need to fully download every transaction and execute it to get the current state of the system, to get the current state of the chain, right? You need all the account balances, all the storage slots, all the contract storage, so that you can then, if a new block with a new transaction is invalid, you can prove it's invalid, right? So you need to fully validate the chain, fully download it and validate it to be able to produce fraud proofs. But that's not ideal, right? So what does Celestia do? Celestia takes a different approach, which is that we have this, we kind of do two things that are distinct, that are different from what like a classical Ethereum style chain would do. One of them is that so the Celestia chain, isn't completely stateless. It's not like all it does is order transactions and that's it. It has a very small state machine that just manages the Celestia validator set. Because it's a proof of stake chain, it uses Tendermint, it needs a validator set, so it needs an enshrined state machine just to manage the validator set. That's all it does. And it also pays fees for the inclusion of rollup blocks. Right? But now here's the trick. So on Ethereum, if you want to include a rollup block and post this data to Ethereum, you need to include that rollup block as call data in an Ethereum transaction. And the problem is that in order to validate this transaction and compute the state that is a result of the execution of this transaction, you need to hash the call. You need to hash the entire transaction, which includes all of the call data. So you need to download all of this call data, even though the EVM doesn't really do anything with it, right? Celestia does something different, which is that we have a special transaction type that doesn't include the rollup block. Rather, it includes a hash of the rollup block. And what this means is you can validate the Celestia state machine without fully downloading all of this, what we call message data, without downloading all of the rollup block data. You just download the data, the tiny amount of data, for the Celestia state machine, for the Celestia validator set. And the rest, you don't have to download it if you want to compute the Celestia state. Okay, so that's the first thing we do. The second thing we do is we note that the if a block is erasure coded incorrectly. Let me backtrack a bit. So this means that if you want to produce a fraud proof for the Celestia state, you can do so without fully downloading every Celestia block. Right? In Ethereum, you have to fully download every Ethereum block and execute every transaction. In Celestia, you only have to download the transaction data, but not the message data. You still have to execute every transaction, but there'll be far fewer, and it'll be far simpler, because it's literally just moving a few coins around. There's no smart contracts. Right, so to produce a Celestia block, you don't have to download to produce a Celestia state fraud proof, you don't have to download all of the Celestia blocks. Now, there's another type of fraud proof in the system, which is that if the erasure coding, which you said, you know, way back in the beginning, erasure coding is used for data availability sampling. If the erasure coding is done incorrectly, you also need a fraud proof for that. But because the erasure coding is done on a per block basis, you don't need knowledge across multiple blocks to produce a fraud proof that the erasure coding is incorrect. You only need one block at a time. So this is where we have this notion of partial nodes come in. A partial node does not fully download every Celestia block. Rather, a partial node downloads all the transactions that modify the Celestia state. So it downloads the transactions to the Celestia state machine, which again is very minimal. So it can produce a Celestia state fraud proof, and it downloads a subset of the blocks, so it can produce a fraud proof that the erasure coding was done incorrectly, because that fraud proof is completely stateless. It's entirely just on a block-by-block basis. And in fact, not only is it on a block-by-block basis, it's actually on a row and column basis, so you don't even actually need to download the full block. But anyways, it's on a per-block basis. So this means that partial nodes can contribute fraud proofs to the network without having to fully download every single bit in every single bit and byte in every single Celestia block. They can actually contribute fraud proofs to the network. They can contribute state fraud proofs, and they can contribute fraud proofs that individual blocks were erasure coded incorrectly because they only download a subset of the blocks, and they can do so for very cheaply. The resource requirements of these partial nodes is very low. They're, in fact, give or take somewhere around the resource requirements of a light node, modulo however many blocks they decide to download to construct fraud proofs for the bad erasure coding. So, and this is because, you know, the erasure coding fraud proofs are stateless, and the state machine is also very minimal. So combining these two things, it means we have access to this new node type that doesn't exist and that can't exist in systems like Ethereum without like enormous changes to make them stateless. We have this new node type that allows people with very low resource requirements to still contribute security to the network, to still contribute to being able to produce fraud proofs.
So this would basically allow an intermediary node in this, and correct me if I'm understanding this wrong, an intermediary node you're referring to here could basically be interested in a particular rollups transactions. Doesn't have to download all the Celestia blocks, but it can download just enough for some rollup and then provide fraud proofs for that to the light clients. Okay. Yep. Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you for that.
That's exactly correct, because like a lot of thought went into designing the system like this, because like you said, if the only thing that could produce fraud proofs was a full node that had to fully download and store every block, that would be rather cumbersome, right? Like not just fraud proofs, but also serving data to the network. So that's why we designed this intermediate node, this partial node, that kind of allows you to contribute storage to the network and also allows you to contribute the creation of fraud proofs without requiring you to do all the work.
This is all I had for this podcast. Do you have any final comments before we wrap this up?
Let's see. So, keep your eye, for anyone who's interested in Celestia, keep your eyes peeled. We have two approaches to kind of bootstrapping the network, primarily for Ethereum EVM targeted applications. I think earlier I talked about Sevmos being one of them and Celestiums being the other. I talked at length about Celestiums. I should probably briefly talk about Sevmos as well. Sevmos is a settlement layer. Settlement layer essentially verifies proofs. It verifies fraud proofs or it verifies validity proofs. In other words, it allows it serves as like a communication medium or a communication bridge between rollups. So we're essentially, Sevmos is an EVM sovereign rollup that runs on top of Celestia, and then you can deploy rollups, just straight up rollups like you would on Ethereum on top of the settlement layer. So now there's a three-layered approach. So Celestia, Sevmos, and then many rollups on top of Sevmos. Now, Sevmos isn't going to be the only settlement layer. We expect many settlement layers to emerge. We expect them to have things like tokens to capture value from the settlement if you so desire. Don't ask me any more about that. The plan is to have Sevmos essentially be EVM equivalent enough that you can literally copy paste rollup smart contracts from Ethereum and just fork them and paste them on top of Sevmos. And this will then, Sevmos itself will only do settlement. It won't do general purpose smart contracts. It'll only do settlement between rollups. So this means all the actual applications, like dApps and so on, will be deployed on top of rollups at the third layer. And we expect these rollups to work just like they do on Ethereum today, where if you're using a rollup like Arbitrum or like Optimism or ZK Sync or Starkware or any of these rollups, should they be forked and deployed onto Sevmos, then you can use them exactly like you do on Ethereum today, you just copy-paste your dApp. If you're a smart contract developer, if you're a user, you just change your RPC endpoint to whatever the roll-up on top of Sevmos, on top of Celestia's, and you're off to the races.
Do you plan to do this for Fuel? And for those who don't know, Fuel is the optimistic roll-up that that John founded. So I kind of wanted to ask that.
Fuel is planning to launch across several networks. So yeah, you could expect that when the time is right, that it's going to launch on top of Sevmos probably.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that.
good to know. Yeah, so this has been a very exciting conversation. Thank you for joining. It was very enlightening and probably will be challenging for many to understand these concepts because really modular blockchains, they go to the very heart of the scalability problem of blockchains. But hopefully, I think with resources like that, people will be more educated and we'll make more educated evaluations on these. It was great to host you, John. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me. It was great to be on.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on your podcast app, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter or LinkedIn. Stay tuned for the next episode, out soon.